In 2004, there were 10,000 chronically homeless people in Connecticut. Today, it's less than 3,000, and there are plans in place to bring that number down to zero. Connecticut is one of six states taking part in Zero 2016. It's a national campaign to end homelessness. Hartford's Journey Home is about to embark on the 100-day challenge. They'll create a plan to eliminate bureaucratic barriers and bring stakeholders together to make a plan to end homelessness here. Before we introduce our guests today for this conversation, we want to bring in writer Susan Campbell. She's going to introduce us to one of Connecticut's chronically homeless residents.
I want to tell you about Salvatore Pena. Sal's a 52-year-old who grew up on Long Island and came to Connecticut some 20 years ago.
What got me in the situation that I'm in is I was right after my mother passed away, and I had gotten into a very heated argument with my stepfather. And he said to me that in January 1st, 1995, you are out of this house. I don't want to see you. I don't want to look at you. I don't even know you around.
In official parlance, Sal is chronically homeless, which is how the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development describes someone who's been homeless for a year or more, or who has had at least four incidences of homelessness in 3 years and has a disability. Sal more than fits the description. He has effectively been homeless since he came to Connecticut in the 90s. Some of that time, he spent living on the streets and sleeping under bridges.
My trek to Connecticut started in Albany. From Albany, I went to Syracuse. From Syracuse, I got shipped to Bristol, Connecticut.
Bristol, not New Britain.
Where I was in a drug and alcohol treatment facility. But I was not there for drugs or alcohol. I was there mostly for my anger.
Did it help?
Yes, it did. I migrated here to Hartford, and I've been here ever since.
He has diabetes, which he medicates, and he has bipolar disorder, which he doesn't medicate because he says the drugs he was given years ago made him groggy.
I just took the whole bottle. I took all the pills that were in the bottle. I threw them right down the toilet.
That was a while ago.
That was a long time ago.
And you haven't tried again?
I haven't touched it since.
That bad of an experience?
That bad.
I met Sal a few years ago at a class at Charter Oak Cultural Center's Center for Creative Learning. Sal sat up front with a scowl on his face. He said he didn't want to be there, but he kept coming back, and he once wrote an essay that broke my heart. Sal wrote about the most important people in his life, and each paragraph ended with, "But I don't see him no more." These days, Sal craves the stability a home of his own would provide.
I would like to be in an apartment somewhere, just to have my own space, do what I want, come and go as I please, do my own thing.
With his own place, Sal can maybe have a girlfriend over and play his Dean Martin music as loud as he wants.
Everybody, that one.
You're going to sing more?
I've heard that song so many times, I've got it memorized.
Do you really?
Yes, I do.
Sing more. Sing more of it.
If you want, I'll sing the whole thing to you. But I don't want to do that. I don't want to cause a scene.
Connecticut is on the cusp of reaching some significant goals in reducing chronic homelessness. Next month, several parts of the state, including the greater Hartford area, will participate in a 100-day challenge during which activists, advocates, service providers, and others will, in 100 days, build a new crisis response system and house as many people like Sal as possible. Last year, New Haven participated in a similar challenge, and that town decreased their chronically homeless population by more than 75%. Matt Morgan, Executive Director of Journey Home, based in Hartford.
We are working now to try to renovate the whole system of how people access emergency shelter, transitional housing, rapid rehousing, and permanent supportive housing programs, which are all the programs that prioritize the homeless population. And we're also trying to think outside the box.
The challenge is the brainchild of Nadine Mata, President of Rapid Response Institute. The idea is people with skin in the game choose their goal and then move heaven and earth to reach it. The 100-day challenge has worked for building rice production in Madagascar and improving factory worker safety in Sao Paulo. Why not homelessness in America?
The 100 days, paradoxically, is liberating when sometimes the unthinkable happens and people actually emerge from that feeling really good about the experience of having done something completely unimaginable.
The idea is to acknowledge that the current system that is supposed to serve people who are homeless has just kind of happened over the years, and it isn't always the most effective or efficient way to get people housed.
Well, you can't quite throw out the rules. You can't do anything that's against the law, of course. But what we have found is that there is a lot more room for maneuvering in the current rules than people really realize.
Matt Morgan again.
The biggest challenge would be for those who have been rejected so many times in their lives that they don't have any trust in any of the services or programs or agencies that are trying to help, and who will refuse to be housed, refuse what can be offered, or refuse to accept a community help.
Of course, there are other barriers. One tool used as a kind of triage to measure the needs of people who are homeless is called the Vulnerability Index Service Prioritization and Decision Assistance Tool, or VSPIDAP for short. The tool helps determine what resources people need to get and stay housed. People are scored based on those needs. Sal's VSPIDAP score is a 2, which means by VSPIDAP standards, he should be capable of living on his own in public or transitional housing. The score for the most vulnerable is 20. Sal's score does not reflect that he has diagnoses both physical and mental. In order to stay housed, he's going to need permanent supportive housing or housing with services such as case management and job training. That sounds expensive, and what I'm about to say may sound counterintuitive. But even providing all the support services Sal needs for the rest of his life is cheaper than keeping him on the streets. For example, last year, the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness released a study that said every person who is chronically homeless costs roughly $31,000 a year. That's $31,000 for the salaries of police officers who move them out of public parks, time spent in jail, emergency room visits, and hospitalizations. But getting someone like Sal into permanent supportive housing with a case manager costs roughly $10,000 a year. That's $21,000 in savings. And the benefits go beyond the person being housed.
When people become housed and stabilized in housing and integrated into communities, it strengthens the whole community. This 100-day campaign, we're not going to get every single person that's homeless housed. But what I believe the campaign will do is by changing the system in a way that makes it easier for people to access these housing resources and targeting the systems and the programs to meet the people where they are and to get them housed according to their level of need instead of according to their ability to jump through hoops and hurdles. Through this effort, we're going to unleash the power that we have to sustain for at least another 2 years to get to the zero chronically homeless number that we want to ultimately get to.
But Morgan is optimistic, in part because Connecticut is so close. Take, for example, veterans who are homeless. In 2012, 1,000 veterans were homeless in Connecticut. Last January, 400 were counted, according to the Connecticut Heroes Project. That's a significant drop.
If any state in this entire country can do it, we can do it in Connecticut. We are a small state, and that is a advantage in this work, because our state government, as a society, we can do better. In this country, the number one country in the world when it comes to wealth, we can achieve this.
And if this gets a house for Sal, all the better.
I would love to end my homeless life. I would love to end it.
That's Susan Campbell. We'll be reporting on Sal and the progress of the 100-Day Challenge for WNPR in the coming months. Campbell's an author, former columnist for the Hartford Courant, and she writes at the blog Dating Jesus. Coming up, she'll join us in studio with Matthew Morgan from Journey Home and Lisa Tepper-Bates, executive director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. We'd like you to join this conversation. Can we end homelessness here in Connecticut, in America? Call us 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about homelessness in Connecticut. In the greater Hartford area, advocates are undertaking a 100-day challenge to try and end chronic homelessness. We want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. In our first segment, we met Sal, a chronically homeless man in Hartford who's looking for a place to live. He was profiled by writer Susan Campbell, who's working with us not only to chronicle this 100-day challenge, but also to follow Sal over the next few months. We welcome her into studio now. Susan, good to see you once again. Thanks so much for bringing this story to us, and welcome back to Where We Live.
Thank you, John.
I also want to welcome back to our show Lisa Tepper-Bates, who's Executive Director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Lisa, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
And somebody that you heard in that story, Matthew Morgan, who's Executive Director of Journey Home in Hartford. Matt, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking a bit about the point in time count that you folks just completed last night, and we'll be talking more about some of the policy stuff that Susan references in her story. But first, Matt, I'm wondering if you can just talk about how typical Sal's story is. We heard this one voice, and it's a compelling voice that Susan's going to be profiling for us. But tell us how many other Sals are out there who you work with.
Every person's story is unique, and people come to homelessness for a whole variety of reasons. I think Sal could be very characteristic of many people who are experiencing homelessness, but certainly not all. We see levels of need of a huge variety among the homeless population. But I would say probably a quarter of the people might be identified as chronically homeless, at least in the greater Hartford region.
One of the things that we heard is this very complicated V-SPADAT score, and there's a sense that we can put a number on someone and say this is how many services they need. But Susan's story also seems to suggest that people are falling through the cracks of a system that is meant to help them.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, we've never used anything to help guide our needs assessment. In the past, we've really only relied on people's ability to come through the front door and to have all their documents in order. And for the first time, we're changing that kind of first come, first serve reality of getting into housing programs to a needs assessment. And so there is no perfect tool that will predict anyone's needs in the future or the present. But it's a starting point. And we're going to be evaluating it. This is the first time we're using it. We're going to be evaluating it on an ongoing basis. And it's not the only factor we're looking at. We're looking at a lot of other things as well, you know, like whether they are sleeping outside, are they frequent users of the emergency room of inpatient facilities, as well as have they served in the military. There's lots of different programs that have unique eligibility criteria for people.
Lisa, you want to pick up on this?
Sure. And I do want to thank you for the question. There's no way to assess the needs or the potential of any individual, whether it's one of us or someone who's experiencing homelessness. So that's a very fair point made in the story. But what we do know is that using a standardized assessment like the V-SPADAT, communities which are ahead of Connecticut in doing this, have made tremendous progress in helping a variety of programs, a variety of providers get around one table and understand the individuals in their community from the same perspective. And that's really important. And as Matt said, it's a tremendous improvement over the past when whether a person seeking services could actually present themselves well and with all their documents might have been the deciding factor in whether they got the service they needed. And someone who couldn't do that but really needs help may have been entirely left out in the cold. So it's not a perfect system, but we believe it is better, and it's an essential piece of helping our providers collaborate and bring our resources together in a much more effective way than in the past.
You say that other states use something similar. Who are our benchmarks? Who's doing this really well?
Right. There are actually about 100 communities across several countries that have used the V-SPADAT. The most notable experiences around this have been in LA County, which was one of the first places. One of the epicenters of homelessness in America is Skid Row in LA, where over 40 providers that sometimes had been very much at odds with each other over the right way to seek to end homelessness came together using this tool so that they could develop what our friends and colleagues in Hartford are developing and other communities, a way to come together, understand the homeless population in that community, and then start to say, one person at a time, what does this person seem to need? What does this person seem to need? Let's get them housed in the way that will help them the most.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Susan, I'd just like you to comment on that briefly, because this whole idea of identifying who chronically homeless people are is, I think, such a key thing to the story that you're trying to tell here. We can identify people who are without homes right now, but the chronically homeless, people who fall into Sal's category, are the people in most need of some sort of support, and trying to identify them and then help them is the key to making this all better.
I'll let Lisa address the revolutionary part about this, but Matt Morgan said at last night's training that this is the first time we're doing this kind of thing. And what intrigues me about this is we're going to know these people by name. We're not just going to know that guy on the corner. We're going to know it's Sal, and these are his diagnoses. These are the services that he needs, and these are the people who cost the most. Whatever your morality is around homelessness, these are the people who are the high users, who they take so much money in public health alone. And if we can get them housed and get them services, there's a huge cost savings to everybody.
And, of course, that's one of the really good things about making some headway in counting and then reducing homelessness over the course of the last couple of years, is as the numbers get smaller, a lot easier it is to know who the people are individually. It's not just a group of people. It's people. It's
exactly.
Individuals.
Yeah.
I want to get to a few phone calls at 860-275-7266, because people are addressing some of the questions that I know I want to get to. Doug's in Weathersfield. Hi, Doug.
Hey. Basically, the question is about the cost savings. And the question is, why would someone who is, let's say, given a home, suddenly stop using emergency room services or something like that?
Doug, thank you.
It seems like an optimistic cost saving.
I thank you very much, and it allows us to get into something we were talking about off air about the real costs. We cite a Florida study that talks about some $31,000 for chronically homeless people on the streets. That's how much it costs for cops and for emergency room services and everything. Lisa, I know that you have some numbers that are more Connecticut-specific that aren't even quite that rosy, but I think Doug is asking the same question I am. Just because you get people off the street doesn't mean they're not taking other services. Maybe you can help Doug out.
Sure. And Doug, that is a good question and a fair question. But what we have seen nationally, and I think this actually probably is not a surprise to us, when people are outside homeless, they are much more likely to be very ill. And they are much less likely to have a systematic way to look after their health needs or to access the supports and resources that they need, whether it's mental health treatment and the medications they need, or the needs that they have in terms of physical health conditions, such as diabetes or kidney failure. So what we do actually know in Connecticut are that people who are homeless are much more likely to access emergency rooms for basic medical care and much more likely to be hospitalized for conditions that, if treated properly, would not require those emergency hospitalizations. And I can tell you that from 2012 data, we know that of the homeless population in Connecticut, which is on the order of 14,000 people in a year, 1,300 people were also very high users of Medicaid. And in that data set, we know that there were 1,300 people who used at least $20,000 of Medicaid resources. The average was $50,000 of Medicaid resources. The highest use by one person was $350,000 worth of Medicaid services.
And that's just Medicaid services. That's not including some of the other things that Florida study was talking about police time and everything else, right?
That's correct. And so what we do know is if you can take one of these people who becomes sicker when they are on the streets on a park bench rather than in a real housing unit, and when they do not have some support to stay connected to basic medical care, we know that they're going to cost a lot more. And we know that we can house them and provide support services to keep them healthy and stable for about $20,000 a year.
Matt, did you want to pick up on that?
Sure. I can actually give you a specific example. We had someone in the greater Hartford area that had spent $250,000 in Medicaid the year before he entered supportive housing program, and he was a frequent user of inpatients and ERs. Since he's been housed, he has only been to the ER once for diabetes and has not had a single inpatient visit. I mean, it's a huge success. It's the extreme, you know, very, very high cost user. But as you said, it's not the only cost. Medicaid And even the other, the police, the things that are easily quantifiable, they don't even get at those intangible costs of the community cost, the flight of talent, you know, from a certain neighborhood, you know, where there's a lot of homelessness or, you know, investment, you know, can be affected greatly. So there's other, all these other impacts, quality of life that can be affected by this population.
And before we get to our next phone call, Susan, I know it's something that we've talked about in the past, and it seems like it comes up over and over again in our show as we talk about politics and policy. One thing I've learned from Connecticut, both you and I came from outside Connecticut and have made our careers here, is once you come to Connecticut, you realize that if you can make a case for someone's pocketbook, they'll do something about it. And if you can't make a case for someone's pocketbook, it's true. Yeah. You know, you're making an economic case for why something's gonna make sense for people really does resonate. It resonates at the state capitol, at City Hall, and just with everyday folks. And I think that being able to fine-tune that case for here's how much it costs in both tangible and intangible ways to have someone on the street, and here's how much it costs to find them a home, I think that those are real numbers that can get people excited about getting behind this.
Yes, because, again, whatever your morality, if this makes fiscal sense, both short and long term, Sal has texted me this morning. He's at the emergency room. It's around his diabetes. If he was in permanent supportive housing, his case manager would have caught this and would have helped him manage his diet, which he tries to do, but he's in a shelter. So absolutely, you can make the case for this one person that you'll have a huge cost saving. So what's not to like about it?
We're talking with Susan Campbell and Matt Morgan and Lisa Tepper Bates. We're talking about homelessness in Connecticut. It's the start of a 100-day challenge where advocates in the greater Hartford area are trying to end homelessness, chronic homelessness. It's one of several initiatives like this. We're going to find out how they're working and what we can do to help. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Lisa's in New Britain. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Good morning. It's Lisa Backus from the New Britain Herald.
Hi there.
Hi. My question would be if Matt could explain how the challenge works. Somebody's beeping in on my phone. Sorry about that. How the 100-day challenge works and how they could possibly replicate that in New Britain, which is the area that I cover.
Lisa, thank you very much for the question. So talk about this 100-day challenge.
Sure. So it's based on the rapid results approach that's been used all over the world. And it's basically there's going to be two teams. One is made up of key leaders and stakeholders, policymakers, and the other team is made up of frontline workers that work directly with the homeless population, those who know exactly why their clients cannot get into the programs that exist in the community or what those barriers are that need to be removed. The frontline, we'll call them the 100-day team, the frontline staff, they will be setting the goal and the strategies for this campaign. It's basically handing them the power and saying, you guys are the real experts. What do we need to do to meet this goal, to set the goal, meet the goal in 100 days? The leadership team, their role is basically to clear the brush, to do whatever it takes to implement what this 100-day team says is necessary to meet that goal of ending chronic homelessness.
How many people do you have working on this? I mean, what's the team?
So far, we have 16 people on the 100-day team that have been identified that are invited, basically, to be a part of the team. There's about 20 members of the leadership team who are the champions, and it's all levels. I mean, the head of HUD for Connecticut is on the team, and she is just – I'm so impressed with how she is championing this cause and really working already at prep work for this campaign. The campaign starts March 9th, but we're already working to line up housing resources. Also, the Connecticut Department of Housing, they've already been working hand-in-hand with HUD and with service providers in our region to line up the housing. There's a whole other group of people that are working on reducing barriers to entry, like getting the identification or trying to expedite ways for disability verification. That's another requirement to get into housing. And just yesterday, I met with InterCommunity, and they're willing to expedite the everything that they can do, getting medical records for people if that's what someone needs to verify an address, you know, even if it's at a shelter. All kinds of things are happening at the ground level. And it's not just those. There's DMIS, Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services is involved. lots of other shelter and housing providers are involved, as well as the Housing Authority. The Hartford Housing Authority is really engaged. And I have to also say that Greater Hartford is not the only region doing the 100-Day Campaign. There are three other regions in the state that are going to be running simultaneous 100-Day Campaigns in their communities. And Lisa can probably talk a little bit more about those.
Yeah, because Lisa from New Britain was asking about, you know, can this come to her community? Where else is this happening at the same time?
Well, what's very exciting is that Eastern Connecticut is launching two teams, one for Southeastern Connecticut and one for Northeastern Connecticut. And our colleagues in Fairfield County will also be joining in the 100-Day effort with a team focused on the homelessness of single adults and a team focused on the homelessness of families. So this is going to be a great effort. And in tandem with the effort that already was a great success in New Haven, we will have covered a lot of the state with this important tool.
There's another initiative going on called Zero 2016. This is a national effort. Connecticut is one of six states in the country selected to do this. So lest our audience get too confused about the various things going on, what is Zero 2016 and how does it link in with any of the things that we're talking about here?
Right. And thank you. That's a great question. Zero 2016 is a campaign aimed at two headline goals, ending veteran homelessness by the end of 2015, the end of this year, and ending chronic homelessness, that is the homelessness of people who have been out on the streets a long time and live with a disability, ending their homelessness by the end of 2016. And the way, John, that we think about this, these 100-day initiatives are meant to really accelerate our community's progress in getting together around these goals and figuring out new ways to collaborate so that we can reach especially those two goals and keep going so that we can end family homelessness and end the homelessness of other populations as well.
Susan, it sounds as though so far when it comes to a problem of, say, veterans homelessness, something that has gotten a lot of attention as the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have ended and we've ended up with a lot of recent veterans on the streets. It seems as though, not just in Connecticut, but in the nation, we are doing better at those numbers by really concentrating our efforts there.
And that's precisely why. It's because we are paying attention to it. And when we shift our attention to people who are chronically homeless, family homelessness, youth who are homeless, then we will also address those. I just wanted to say one thing. We should blame Lisa Tepper Bates for bringing the Rapid Results Institute idea to homelessness in Connecticut. I'm correct, right? It's your fault.
Well, yes, Susan, I suppose it is. And I'm proud to be blamed for that. But it is the providers who really picked up that opportunity in New Haven and have helped to show others in the state how much you can do in a short period of time to really retool our efforts within the resources we have and do better by the population we're trying to serve.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk about ending homelessness in Connecticut, it's not as crazy as it sounds. It's something that the advocates we're talking with today are trying to do in very rapid fashion. If you want to join us also, you can join us online now at Where We Live on both Facebook and Twitter. Matt Morgan, you were up all night, right? This is from what I understand, because the point in time count is something that we've covered in the past, and you can explain exactly what that is. It was rescheduled because of some really terrible weather that we've been having, and it's obviously it's an important time of the year to be counting the homeless population, finding out where people are because, well, we're having some very dangerous conditions outside. Maybe you can explain what a point in time count is and how it's conducted.
Sure. It's basically, it's one way to measure longitudinally over time, you know, our progress and the numbers of homelessness in the state of Connecticut. And what's really important about it is that it includes an unsheltered count. So we have volunteers going out into the community really, really early this morning in Greater Hartford and going block by block looking and trying to identify people that are experiencing homelessness. And then we're actually doing the VI SPDAT needs assessment survey with them that will provide the prep work and the data that we will need to begin the 100-day campaign as part of this point-in-time count.
Does this get easier every year as you learn more about it? Does it get harder? I mean, tell me about the evolution of this, because this is something that you do on a regular basis. What are you learning year by year?
Well, I think one of the major changes that's happened over the years is we're able to use technology more and more. We have a homeless database for the state, and they are getting better and better at just pulling information from the database on a daily basis. So, I mean, you know, it's we could pull a point in time count any day of the year using the database system of who's in the shelters. But the challenge, as I said, is getting all of the volunteers and going out under the bridges, tromping through snow up to our knees this morning, you know, looking for people in tents, and then doing these assessments with them.
Susan, and you went out last night. You've done this in the past. What do you see? I mean, explain to people who you find and where you go and what you see when you do this.
You see incredibly resilient people who have the survival skills that you will never have, who are living in tents by the river, who are living in underneath bridges, and they arrange their living quarters as homes. There's a living room area, there's a cooking area, there's the place where they sleep, and it really will break your heart because they decorate. And you see, at least when I've gone out, and I'm in no way, I don't go out every week, Dave DeVerge of South Park Inn does, but you see mostly men, although there are women out there. I've never seen a child. I hope I never do. And they are very vulnerable. They're tough. It's weird. They're very tough because they're living outside, but they are incredibly vulnerable.
When you talk about the resiliency, it's something just in my mind, it made me remember a show we did not too terribly long ago about people who come to this country without English language skills. And we often say, well, if you could just learn English, then you can get everything together and you'll learn more and it'll be better. But we sort of discount right away the fact that they're bringing with them bilingual skills that many of us wish we had. They actually speak one or two or three languages, and we just throw out all the things they do have. And we just want them to do this other thing. You seem to be describing people who have a type of resilience and toughness that many of us wish we had and that would probably serve us all very well in the workplace and in school. But we don't tend to honor that. We tend to look at the other thing, the thing that, you know, they can't get a roof over
their heads. What we believe to be the negative. But you do have people under the bridges who have jobs and have incredible work ethics. You cannot assume anything about the person you meet under a bridge. They could have college degrees. They could have all manner of what would look like to be support, but something happened, and there they are.
Lisa?
I think that's right, Susan. There's an incredible variety of people that we find. And just to go back to the pit for a moment, we had over 300 volunteers out last night across the state helping to complete this effort and collect this information. And John, it is the first year that we have systematically not just counted who's out there and what are their characteristics, but use this opportunity to reach each one of these people, as Matt said, and to do this assessment. But to the issue of their strengths, we've talked a lot about how the VI-SPADAT helps us understand whether they're mentally ill or have kidney failure or other fragilities. But the best of our providers will always say, we have to work from the strengths as well. And I think we are all, as a community of people trying to end homelessness, getting our minds more and more around that fact that we want to know where we have to help, but we also want to help every person and every family who is homeless to access their own best strengths, to help themselves create that good future and that pathway to housing. And if we're not helping them with their strengths, then we're not doing the job we need to do.
I want to get to a quick question here. Our friend Doris Sugarman from the Connecticut Forum joins us. Doris, hi, good to speak with you.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, I was out this morning, actually with Susan, you know, as part of the unsheltered count. We went out rather early and combed the streets and tried to find the unsheltered homeless to administer this survey. You know, we found a shelter, you know, an abandoned little hut that obviously someone was living in, but thankfully they were not there. We had a great leader. I'm just curious as to why the annual count is done in January instead of in the warmer months when the count would be more accurate.
Lisa?
So thank you for that question, and that's one that we do have to answer a lot. This is a HUD requirement, so HUD really sets the timeline around when they want this count to be done, and it is usually in the last week of January. Again, our count had to be postponed due to the weather. But that's a fair question. And asking our friends at HUD why that's the case, it is because they believe that in this extreme cold weather, we will find those who are most in need and have no alternatives as the people who are going to be identified on the streets and in the shelters.
We're going to get to some more phone calls in just a bit. A lot of what we're talking about requires people to really pay attention to the issue of homelessness and try to figure out how they can help. We went to the streets of Hartford. Our intern, Kelsey Bissell, talked with some folks to get some of their thoughts about how they can help the homeless in Connecticut. Let's listen.
Is homelessness an important issue to you?
Absolutely, especially when you live downtown. You see it all the time.
Not compared to other cities I go to. I just came back from New York. It was quite evident there. It's not really evident on the streets of Hartford.
In this weather, not having a home is not an option for survival.
What should we do to help end homelessness in the greater Hartford area?
Well, everybody's homeless for a different reason, basically. And you need to address those reasons.
Yeah. Plenty of work to do in the greater Hartford areas. Plenty of strong hands in these shelters. Eager people who want to work.
You can definitely give businesses downtown at least an incentive to help homelessness downtown, but it's also the government's duty to make sure that all the citizens have at least shelter and food. So, I mean, it could be a mix, right?
I wanted to ask you about that, Matt, because as we talk to people about it, something that strikes me is that there's a couple different ways in which general people who don't have an experience of homelessness themselves think about it. On one hand, they think about homelessness as a chronic problem in society, like many other things that might be a chronic problem. And there's another group of people who maybe view it more as individuals, like you do, who are, for whatever reason, not under shelter at the moment. I guess I'm wondering if you could talk for a moment about public attitudes toward homelessness in a city like Hartford, where maybe you don't see it on the streets in the way that you do in some other large metropolitan areas, and how people respond to you about the work you do, how they respond to people who are without shelter now.
Yeah, I think one of the most shocking things that people don't realize is that any one of us could become homeless tomorrow. We separate ourselves from this population and stigmatize them, but you know, so many people, there was an accident on the job, you know, that resulted in a brain injury or something, and you know, slowly you begin to burn your relationships, and with your friends or family, you wear out your welcome. And many people don't have family or friends with, you know, with lots of supportive, you know, systems. And so I guess, you know, I met a man and I interviewed him who was a Yale graduate. He had been a millionaire and was a huge real estate mogul. And, you know, I'm a Yale graduate as well. And it was like looking at myself almost in the face, like realizing like this could be me that I'm talking to, who this person is now, you know, in a shelter. He basically, after, you know, 2008, lost everything and ended up, you know, having burnt his bridges with his family and friends and ended up in a shelter. So like people don't realize it's us, it's me, it's, you know, So I think people's attitudes can change dramatically once they realize that fact.
We're talking with Matthew Morgan, who's executive director of Journey Home in Hartford. Also, Lisa Tepper Bates, who's executive director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. And our friend Susan Campbell, she's an author, former columnist for the Hartford Courant, who blogs at datingjesus.net. She brought us this story of Sal, someone who is chronically homeless. She's going to be telling Sal's story for us over the course of the next few months as we engage in a 100-day challenge here in the greater Hartford area, trying to end homelessness. One Facebook message before he had to break from Jeff Clark. He says, here we build baseball stadiums with tax dollars so a few can make money, but we don't build affordable housing and help the homeless. My mother always said, do your chores first, then you can play baseball. If we're ever going to live up to Ronald Reagan's pontification of being that shining city upon the hill, we'd better listen to what our mothers told us. Thanks, Jeff. You can also tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Beaker blogger and WNPR science reporter Patrick Scahill will fill us in on some of the latest science news. We'll hear about how wind chill actually works. We know it's cold, but how do they calculate it? We'll also hear about earthquakes and Connecticut's fascinating geological history. A little later in our program tomorrow, we'll also hear about a new book that examines NASA's role in the civil rights movement. That's all coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live.
What's the biggest barrier for somebody who is homeless trying to secure housing?
Money being the number one reason. The second reason is information. Most people who are homeless are also uneducated.
Making that first step off the street, it's such a cycle.
Being homeless comes with like a stigma, and a lot of people don't want to be associated with that.
There are barriers to entry to the system that need to be challenged. If you don't have a permanent address, it's hard to send out a resume, which is hard to get a job. It's hard to then have money for housing.
Just that self-esteem, knowing that, you know, you can be better than your situation, knowing that it's something you could do for yourself to better yourself, basically. You're not always going to be homeless. Know that there's something better for you.
Those are some voices gathered by Kelsey Bissell, our intern in downtown Hartford. We're talking about homelessness in the program today with people who work on this issue on a daily basis. Susan Campbell brought us the story of Sal, a chronically homeless man who she's going to be following for us over the course of the next few months as the greater Hartford area undergoes a 100-day challenge to try to end homelessness. We're also joined by Matthew Morgan from Journey Home and Lisa Tepper Bates from the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. In the last few minutes we've got a few people who have questions about the project we're undergoing right now, including Robert in East Hampton. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, John. How are you?
Good. What's up?
Good. Hey, John, you know, I'm just kind of listening to the conversation, and I'm a little concerned about, you know, the expectations of performing something like this within 100 days. And also, you know, the cost of you threw out the figure of $35,000 to kind of correct the problem. But I find, you know, once they get into services, I mean, I think the services are going to be so great between, you know, drug addiction, alcoholism, mental illness. I mean, and then you throw on housing on top of that. I mean, where does all this funding come from?
Well, Robert, thank you very much for the question. And I want to get a quick answer to that. Maybe Lisa Tepper Bates can help. We talked about the money before, and this is a really important point. Maybe you can just talk to Robert a bit about some of his questions.
Sure. And thanks for the question. So there are a lot of resources out there right now that we need to use to best effect. Now, when we think about the housing voucher portion of what some people need, there are people who are severely disabled and are homeless, and they will need a housing voucher and they will need some support services to be stable. And we know, as we discussed earlier, that there is a great public savings, even though that's a relatively expensive package. That's about 20 or 25% of the homeless. There are a lot of folks who are homeless who need a little bit of help to get back into housing. And that platform of housing, this idea that we've talked with you, John, about before, housing first, getting people back in the door of their own housing is a first and very important step to helping them help themselves, to get a job, to connect with existing services in the community for mental health or existing services for substance abuse treatment that will help them stabilize their lives. Not everyone needs the most expensive level of intervention. Some people just need a little bit of help to get housed, and good things follow from that.
And it's stabilization, it seems, more than anything else. It's stabilizing someone's life and situation so that they can, as some of our Man in the Street interview folks said, that they can then help themselves to do the next thing. I want to get to one more call here. Tom's calling. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I think what really needs to be touched on is how much mental health is a factor here. In a lot of aspects, different aspects of life here in Connecticut, I'm a retired correction officer. I tell you right now, the jails, the prisons are full of people with serious mental health problems, and I think that's probably the main driver of a lot of the homelessness is the mental health issues.
I think that you're absolutely right, and Susan, this is something we've talked about before. It's a serious, serious problem.
Particularly when you're talking about chronically homeless, but I would not want to be the numbers person here. I don't actually I know a number that gets bandied about, but if you look at people who are chronically homeless, do they say 40% are dealing with some sort of mental illness, or did I just make that up?
Chronically homeless actually means that there is some kind of a disability that the person has. It could be physical. It could be a physical disability. Usually it's a mental illness.
And, John, just to use some actual numbers, we talked a little earlier about the overlap population between the homeless and the high users of Medicaid. About 80% of those who are homeless and cost our public systems more than they would if we would house them properly. About 80% of those people do have a severe and potentially disabling mental illness. So to your caller's point, it is very well taken.
Roberta's in Bloomfield. Hi, Roberta. Go ahead.
Hi, John. This is Roberta from Prosser Library. I wanted to let you know that the library is hosting a program on February 26th at 6:30 p.m. It's called The Faces of Homelessness. And the unique thing about this is that we're actually going to be hearing from people who have experienced homelessness. We're able to do this because we're co-sponsoring with the Bloomfield Interfaith Association. So we're inviting people to come down and join us on February 26th at 6:30.
Roberta, thank you so much for that. And if you could send us some more information, too, we'll put it on our website at WNPR.org so people know more about it, all right?
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We got an anonymous question from someone who called and said, if we're trying to get families out of shelters, how will we reach the families and children to offer services in the future?
I don't understand that question.
Well, I think what one of the things that was mentioned is we're trying to get families out of shelters. That's one place where we know that we can identify people who might need help. I guess the question is, how do we provide these services for families and children? We've talked a lot about individuals. We've talked about veterans. What do we do for families?
Right, and that's a great question and a very important one. Our primary responsibility for anyone who's homeless, whether a single adult or a family, is to get them housed and then to provide the services around them. I guess I would perhaps ask the person who raised that question whether they're taking into account that there are a lot of different paths to connect people to services, especially with families. They tend to be in more contact with public systems or schools that can help connect them to the kinds of services that we want them to have and that we want their children to have access to. But shelter is certainly not the only path to support.
And I'll just add that one of the programs that's really gaining a lot of ground is rapid rehousing, especially for families. It's being seen as really successful. It's a short-term amount of assistance, but they have their own lease and they do have some support services. And we actually are including with that an employment training component in many parts of the state that's really critical for helping them ultimately get to that independence that they need.
Susan Middletown. Sue, we just have a moment with you. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I just wanted to know, about 2 years ago, I volunteered through the Columbus House in New Haven. It was an initiative called 100,000 Homes, and I helped do vulnerability studies and never heard whatever happened with that. And I want to be hopeful about what this 100 days is going to bring, but if anyone can answer to that, you know.
I think it's a great question. I'll put it to Lisa, and thank you, Sue.
Great. The 100,000 Homes campaign actually succeeded in housing well more than 100,000 vulnerable people across the country. So that campaign was a great success. And in Connecticut, by embracing the Zero 2016 campaign, that's sort of the next iteration of a great national campaign to move the ball and advance the goal. So we're really grateful to Governor Malloy for embracing it. We're grateful to providers like Matt, who is leading the way in getting providers together around this effort. And thank you for remembering the 100,000 Homes campaign. A lot of good came out of that.
And so if people want to find out more about Zero 2016, what would they do?
They can visit our website, cceh.org, and they can learn more about the campaign. And there will be lots of information coming out as we launch March 9th, our 100-day efforts to start the engines going.
And this 100-day challenge, if people want to get involved in this, Matt, the best way for them to do that?
They can visit our website, www.journeyhomect.org. And we can connect you. We're going to need a lot of volunteers. We're going to need a lot of help during that 100 days.
And during these 100 days, Susan, you're going to be joining with us over the course of time. You're going to be profiling Sal. We'll hear his voice again. And you'll come back, and maybe we'll talk about things in a couple months and find out how this challenge is going.
Happy to. Thank you.
Susan Campbell, thanks so much for doing this for us. I really appreciate it. Susan Campbell, of course, an author, former columnist for the Hartford Courant, who blogs at datingjesus.net. Matthew Morgan is executive director of Journey Home in Hartford. Lisa Tepper Bates is executive director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Our program today produced by our executive producer, Katie Talarski. Thanks also to Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyone Wolf, who produce Where We Live. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Thanks to our interns today. I'm John Dankosky. Join me tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on Science Friday and tomorrow on Where We Live.